Okay, welcome back to Millennial 2018, and I'm now here with Josh from No Apologies, which is a YouTube channel. Josh, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Hopefully, this is the first of many millennials to come.
Hopefully. Okay, would you like to tell the audience about yourself and your YouTube channel?
So I have had a YouTube channel the last year, and I did a few videos late last year when I was still in the libertarian kind of community, non-aggression principle, all these kinds of nice things. And I was fairly race realistic before. Because of what I studied in college, I more or less was familiar with things like IQ differences, sex differences, all of the things that are somewhat taboo, I think, in mainstream discourse today. And then the turning point for me was December 2017. Spencer talked to Sargon of Akkad on Andy Warski's show, and I've always maybe I won't be too strong. Sargon of Akkad was not necessarily my preferred YouTube guy, and I was also not really very supportive of Richard Spencer. And just to hear his point of view discussed in kind of an intelligent way with somebody who could push back intelligently made me consider more of what he had to say. I'll be perfectly honest. I thought the guy was like a CIA plant or something. I was a full-on Trump MAGAtard, we're gonna make America great again. It's the wall. All of it's gonna happen. And I got really disillusioned really quickly. So shortly thereafter, the whole channel has moved more in an alt-right direction, pro-white consciousness, pro-traditionalism, anti-liberalism. That's more or less what I talk about the most.
All right. The first question would be obvious. Why did you become disillusioned with Trump so quickly?
So, a friend of mine, Jefferson Lee, who also has a very popular YouTube channel, we got together to do podcasts after Trump got elected almost the very next week. And we were kind of black-pilled libertarians. We weren't looking forward to 2016 before Trump got into things. We thought, wow, God, this is going to be a shit show. The only thing that's going to save this country is an asteroid. And then Trump came in, kind of turned the whole paradigm on his head. Showed the two of us, myself in particular, that this libertarianism was actually a dead end intellectually, even though there was a lot of good ideas and a lot of smart people involved. I started to think that the state and governance and politics is an existential quality. It's not an antagonistic quality. So the libertarian position just takes you out of the game entirely. And what has been happening in America, and I'm sure where you are and all throughout Europe, is just white people not having their states protect them, advocate for them, make policy that defends them. And in fact, it's been the exact opposite. And obviously, that's not a surprise. That's not news to anybody. And so our thinking was day one, based on everything that Trump said on the campaign trail, arrest Hillary Clinton, arrest Barack Obama, clear out the deep state, build the wall, all of these things that were completely radical and we thought at the time would have changed the course of America, had to have been done on day one. And they didn't happen. And then they continued not to happen. And then there were stupid fights about tax cuts. Now, I'm not opposed to some kind of tax reform. Although James Edwards, who I've had in my show, recently said, anytime you hear them say reform, basically that means they're going to make it worse. I didn't vote for the guy to have an extra $20 in my pocket at the end of every week. I voted for him to change the demographic course of the nation. I voted for him to to jail treasonous journalists and to throw these globalist politicians in the gulag, metaphorically, although I wouldn't be so upset with an actual gulag. And none of it happened. And then the bombs in Syria happened, and his Twitter rants just seemed more and more ridiculous as less and less happened. And Richard Spencer at the National Policy Institute published a report that basically said that, the vaunted 2050 white minority in America was actually going to happen in 2030. And it's like, well, nothing this guy is going to do is going to change anything. In fact, the whole idea of normie conservatism, Republican GOP, American nationalism is a total canard, and something different has to happen. So I've been really aggressively pushing in that direction.
That is very it's interesting how you seem to have changed quite radically. I mean, are you one of these people? There seems to be quite a lot of them actually who wear MAGApedes, and then something woke them up to that Trump simply wasn't enough. He wasn't even going to deliver what he'd promised, let alone beyond that. I mean, the wall seems to be a massive disappointment. It also, now we've got the Internet Bill of Rights, which, you know, has become a very salient issue, and he doesn't seem to be making any progress on that. But I think for the public who voted for him, the thing really is the wall, isn't it? And that it's terrible that he just doesn't seem to have made any progress in that direction at all, and it's nearly been 2 years.
Well, you know, I foolishly, I think at the time, thought that the wall would have been enough, but the 2016 MAGAPED worldview is, oh my God, illegal immigration. Oh my God, illegal immigration. And then the 2017, I don't know, alt-right, dissident, woke perspective is just all immigration. Frankly, if you're not a white person and you're in a white country, you're contributing to the eradication of white culture. And I don't mean actively. I'm not saying that, you know, every melanated individual is somehow working constructively to end white culture and white prosperity. But by virtue of having higher replacement rates, affirmative action, getting on board with the kind of rainbow coalition of the left, at least insofar as America is concerned, but you see that elsewhere throughout Europe, immigration in and of itself is not going to be good for us. And Donald Trump was saying things like, well, you know, we need skilled workers, all of these jobs that the corporations, you know, GM, you know, we need people for these jobs. So as long as they got the right paperwork, I don't want my kids. I want to have like a gang of kids. I want to go full on Islamic. I want to have a little troop of kids. I don't want them to grow up and have to learn, I don't know, Arabic or Somali or something just to get a job. One thing I could never understand as a kid, when I was in school, two things actually, and I won't, the second one is not so relevant, but I remember coming home from elementary school to my dad and saying, why do I need to learn Spanish to get a job? And he got really angry at me. And I was like, well, isn't this America? In the 90s, it was still very white. I was like, shouldn't everywhere be staffed by white people, employed by white people? Why do I need to learn a foreign language to be competitive in my own country? I'm not against learning languages. It's great. It's very difficult to do. But to be competitive in the market of your own home, that seems that as a kid, that made no sense to me. And now when I have kids, they're going to be in a much worse situation. So yeah, there were a couple of things that radicalized me really quickly. That Trump as a president, as a politician, was not as aggressive as Trump as a candidate. That he kept staffing complete and utter losers, Nikki Haley in the UN. There's that famous New York Times op-ed about some mystery person in the Trump White House that was subverting everything he was doing. The whole thing was foobar from the very beginning, and I just could no longer stomach the feeling of being humiliated. The feeling of I, like many people I know, suffered personally to some degree for our support of Donald Trump, and I'm sure like people in England suffered for their support of Nigel Farage and all these other dissident people over the last 10 or 15 years. And the humiliation of really making an impassioned argument for these people, only for them to do an about face, without getting too fashy too quickly, it made me want to, you know, goose step and do all kinds of things that are way outside of the current paradigm. I'm not totally serious about that, but I mean, I was this close.
I know what you mean. You want some kind of change, because this obviously isn't enough. Let's just put it that way. I don't want to be accused of anything extremist or white supremacist for that matter.
Absolutely. I quickly came to the notion that the whole program of America has to go away, that everything that this country was founded on, if it was ever good in the first place, or effective, it certainly stopped being worth upholding and fighting for long before my generation ever showed up. You know, I didn't think that I would grow up, I would become 30. You know, I'm going to be 33 in a few weeks. I didn't think I would turn 33 and that the world would be the way that it was. You know, there's the great meme. It's a little bit dated now. Old Economy Steve. And it's this guy in the 70s, and it's like, has more wealth than his parents and his children. And it's just all of this boomer kind of stuff. And it's like, I didn't think that when I would hit adult age, that suddenly what was normal for my parents and the people growing up would be considered difficult or, you know, outside of the norm or outside of reason, that I would need to move hundreds of miles away just to own my own property or to marry a woman who wasn't, you know, who hadn't ridden the cock carousel, you know, since she was 14 years old. Like the values that I thought the country was founded on, and that was a borderline misogynist comment. I say that jokingly. The values that I believed in did not exist anymore by the time I reached maturity. And so this whole American system, liberalism, American traditionalism, American exceptionalism, it's all false, and I would like to take the world's largest pickaxe to it and just, you know, stab away until there's nothing left.
God, I can definitely hear your disillusionment for sure. It's very forceful. I don't mean to be patronizing or dismissive, because it's a very, very real thing. I think it is sort of depressing to contemplate that America had was, and it's the same in other countries as well, but especially America, it had so much wealth and potential. And if you were an American, there were good reasons to be optimistic about your future and your children's future and your grandchildren's future, etc. There, I mean, you know, if you think about America in the 50s, America in the 80s seems very optimistic to me. And the 60s and 70s as well, to lesser extent. But basically up until now, up until like the 2000s, I think that if you're an American, you could justifiably be optimistic about life in general and the future of your society. But now it feels like for the first time ever, really, there is doubt. I mean, obviously, every country has goes through bad phases, economic downturns, and so on, and whatever. Vietnam was obviously a bummer, a downer for the nation. But for the first time now, it seems that America doesn't necessarily have a future. I mean, white Americans don't belong to something that necessarily is going to exist in 50 years from now. I don't mean a majority. I mean an actual culture. There might not be a white America 100 years from now. There might be a mixed race, like coffee-colored America 100 years from now. But on the current trends, is there really any grounds for optimism about the or complacency about the fact that there will still be white Americans several centuries from now, and a white America that is a recognizable collective entity 100 years from now? I don't really think there is. And of course, it's the same situation in Western European countries as well. But I think that because America was so high, the fall is that more dramatic, that much more dramatic and depressing and baffling as well. Because, I mean, after all, your grandparents would have been so optimistic about the future, you know, in the 50s. They must have thought, this is just the best life that any people have ever lived. And now you have the young millennial and Gen Z Americans who are not going to have jobs as good as their parents had, might never own a house. I mean, compare that with what a young American could expect. Not even a genius American, an ordinary average American could expect 30 years ago, 20 years ago. This is unimaginable. It's amazing that the change. And then you've got the dereliction that you see. I mean, I saw it myself 2 years ago when I was over there, and apparently Trump's presidency hasn't done much to cure this. The derelict buildings, the roads that aren't looked after, and so on. It is starting to feel like a society that's falling apart. What would you say about all of that?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything patronizing at all about what you said. In fact, that was probably better than I could say it. Yeah, I would say, you know, post 2007 in particular, there was economic and militaristic issues that from 2000 to 2008 that were happening. Obviously, the Twin Towers, Iraq, Afghanistan, all of these things. But that was economic and foreign policy related. But domestically, 2007, obviously, you had the bottoming out of the economy. You had the now at this point in time, I was, you know, I consider myself right wing. That's a nebulous term, but and it certainly means something different in Europe than it does in America. But to the extent that right wing is nationalism, traditionalism, blood and soil philosophy, I'm a right winger. But at that time, I was very liberal. I was like, listen, the war on drugs is stupid. All of this foreign policy stuff is stupid. Capitalism is stupid. Like a lot of this stuff is really, really not as. I don't mean making money is good. Having businesses is good. Having some measure of a market with the freedom and mobility to kind of innovate. These are good things, obviously. But I grew up in a world where everything was, there's a kind of a reification where just everything was stripped of its real meaning, of its real cultural value, and became a thing in and of itself. And so me, a 13-year-old in 2000, 2001, America was McDonald's. It was MTV. It was Tommy Hilfiger. It was just things that I didn't give a shit about. And kids my age did. I was a little bit different from a lot of people growing up. But anyway, so I was kind of I was a quarter shit lib at that point. I would think I'd like to think now that I had a sense of things that would be important for where I am now, right? Because I still think foreign policy is a problem. I still think that the you know, Jeff Sessions style war on marijuana is a dumb thing. I still think that this capitalism in and of itself, that America should care about its economy more than it should care about its culture or its people. I still think those are problems. But yes, you had the bottoming out economically in 2008. You had the Twin Tower incident. I'm from New York. My father almost died that day. We had no idea where he was going to be. The wars that came after that, and like a silly teenager, I was like, yeah, America, go in, kick some Iraqi ass. A few years later, I would regret that tremendously. And then 2008, Barack Obama got elected, and that was very disappointing. Not that funnily, I thought that America. I was kind of a shitlib in this regard. I thought us having a black president would be this healing moment racially, and we could all come together. But then when I saw what that really was going to look like, it wasn't a black guy. It wasn't like a dark skinned Ross Perot or something. It was a globalist stooge who wanted to turn America over to the third world, and he wanted to browbeat white people and browbeat Christianity and foment racial and economic division in the country, which he did. And right around that time, you also saw the negrification of culture. So, like, the pop culture 2000 to 2007, like all of the pop stars were blonde, blue-eyed, thin, big breasts. Everything after 2007 was dark skin, big butts, brown, twerking, hip hop, yada, 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 yada. I'm not saying that, you know, wide hips is a bad thing. I'm not saying that hip hop is a bad thing. I'm a musician. I've played in hip hop groups. I've played in all kinds of music. I have a love of art forms in all of their varieties. I tend to like, you know, white art forms more and white culture more naturally. But not only did the wealth and status of America sink, but then it seemed like to make up for the fact that nobody was going to have a quality of life, like you said, that would be reminiscent of the 1980s or the 1950s. What we got instead was, yes, queen, slay, and gays on Saturday Night Live. And not that I'm saying gay people are bad, but just like the subverting of everything in the United States of America. Again, I wouldn't be opposed to, you know, there's a guy I follow on Twitter who wrote a great article called Homo Nationalism. And he was basically saying that, which is kind of like a Milo Yiannopoulos argument, that there have been many notable gay people in art and science and technology, and you wouldn't want some kind of right-wing death squad purging the gene pool of non-heteros, which I would agree with. But it was just gay is better. Gay is right. Straight is bad. Straight is terrible. Reproducing is bad.
Yeah. And now you've got the same with the trans thing as well. Now that's come in as a sort of, it's obviously a subversive attack on the very notion of male and female, man and woman. But it's also this, I mean, I really find it very disturbing that this is being pushed on kids and being promoted to kids. And that it's being suggested to or stated to kids that there are no men and women. Everyone could be trans. If they haven't decided they are already, then there's always that potential. And it's just something trivial. It's not something very, very serious, but it is. It could hardly be more serious in terms of the person's conception of themselves. And then there are the social ramifications. If you negate the notions of man and women, then that is the bedrock upon which any society rests. I can't even begin to imagine the knock-on effects that this could have, almost certainly will have, in the coming decades. I mean, there's going to be a generation of kids who absolutely detest, loathe, and resent their parents for allowing them to be subjected to this. That's definitely going to happen.
I totally agree. That's what bothers me more than anything. It's bad enough what's happening now. I can grit my teeth and bear it. I don't have to buy the product. Here's the libertarian position. Well, I just don't have to watch. I don't have to buy it. I can just, opt out. That's fine. I'm perfectly fine in my day-to-day life not participating in it. But there's a ticking time bomb planted in every household throughout this country that's going to start detonating 5 years from now, 15 years from now, 30 years from now. And, I consider myself something of a sensitive guy. I have a lot of empathy for people. And when I think about what this is going to do to individuals, what this is going to do to families, the snowballing effect culturally, it is, I don't know a word that is strong enough to describe how tragic that is.
Reprehensible, satanic. As you say, there aren't really adjectives strong enough to describe what we could be facing. The disruption, the psychological disruption and harm that could be getting caused right now to entire generations of kids who are going to be very, very confused. I mean, maybe once puberty kicks in, then things will sort of resolve naturally for a lot of them. I hope so. But it really does scare me because, as deracinated as the millennials often feel, when we were kids, things were far more normal than they are now. So God knows how these kids are going to be when they grow up. It's very scary.
Yeah, there's deracination is a good word for it. There's also just simply nothing truly aspirational about American culture. There's no... the one thing I did like about America, the American culture, is the sense of idealism. This of term I've come to use a lot on these broadcasts is Faustian. This adventurousness, this enterprising quality, this let's take a mad gamble just for the sake of it. Yeah, it could destroy us, but we could also build something beautiful. Ferdinand Magellan circumnavigating the globe. I mean, that's insane. That's completely insane. There's the old Louis C.K. joke. If you went, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, if you went traveling, by the time you got to your destination, you were a different group of people. Like, that's crazy. That's spirit. It reminds me of the Alex Jones bit where he's like,
"Oh yeah, that wonderful rant about Magellan and that striving, conquering, exploring." Yeah, it's wonderful.
He's like, who's the singer? I can't remember that he uses that in that video. Justin Bieber. Justin Bieber ain't cool, folks. Ferdinand Magellan circumnavigated the globe. Yeah, I mean that's just
so good.
It's amazing and. To that point, a guy like Alex Jones, I listened to him virtually every day for like 10 years. And then you come out the other end of this alt-right pipeline and it's like, sorry, dude, he's almost got like a Ben Shapiro mentality. I don't care if Texas becomes Hispanic so long as they all believe in Thomas Jefferson and love Jesus. It's like, that's not enough, dude. That is so not enough. All of these things that I was raised to believe in, Jesus, Christianity, the Bible, the Constitution, I grew up and they're just pieces of paper that nobody has ever cared about, really, not taken seriously. Not, I don't mean you have to be a scholar, but I mean, like, you know, don't pay lip service to these things. You grow up and you realize, ah, everyone, it's fashion. I'm just wearing the Constitution on me I don't know, like it's Ralph Lauren or something.
Yeah, I mean, people, I don't really think that people care about principles as such. They don't kill, they don't die for the sake of principles. Ethnic loyalty, religious loyalty, national loyalty are far more powerful motivating forces than principles. This is something that the individualists just do not get at all.
Well, it took me a while to get that too. And I'm a principled person. And I think if you're a person of principles, it's that egotism where you just project your own psychology onto the rest of the world. So I spent my 20s thinking, well, all I need to, like Stefan Molyneux, all I need to do is make the right arguments. Everyone's going to care about evidence. And nobody cares about evidence. Even the most rational people don't care about evidence. Stefan Molyneux is a good example. He's someone who should know better. His show should be like the biggest signal booster for white nationalism, identitarianism, illiberal philosophy, because he knows better, because he's smart, he's disciplined in a bunch of different fields. And then he goes and does his goofy libertarian podcasts and, well, Ayn Rand and Thomas Sowell. And let me talk to Dinesh D'Souza. And gee, isn't Richard Spencer bad because he's an atheist? It's like, it's all silliness. Sophistry, not the worst thing in the world.
I think the there is that famous phrase, facts don't care about your feelings. But Spencer very cleverly and I think accurately said, feelings don't care about your facts. This is an absolutely true statement. I think this assumption that people are, you know, as you say, rational and logical and objective, and they'll listen to the scientific truth, is just utter nonsense. I don't see anyone doing that except for the types of people who say things like that. They're into facts and reason and evidence and argumentation and all that. But most people, I think, have just no interest, no time, limited capacity for things like that. They need something to love and something to believe in, to have faith in. And whether doing so is rational or not is of zero importance to them, I think.
And it probably should be. I mean, the funny thing, I remember as a kid watching TV, and you would watch whatever was popular in the 80s, in the early 90s. So I was a kid growing up, the TV shows I would watch was, I can't even remember the names of them, but they would all be popular 1983, 1985, whatever. And to portray a kid in high school in the 80s, it's like they're in home ed class or home economics class. They're in woodshop class. And what the hell kind of education did I get? Autistic nonsense. Oh, here's goofball intellectualism for the sake of what? Who knows? It had no bearing. I mean, someone like me would have enjoyed it because I'm, you know, I liked nerdy, brainy stuff. I liked abstracting and reading Greek mythology and just having a whole Herculean epic play out in my brain. But what would have been better for everyone in that classroom was to learn how to balance your budget, learn how to tie a rope, learn how to operate heavy machinery, learn how to cook, life skills. And this whole autism, educational autism of people need to know who Tesla was, and people need to know what year that Thomas Edison, blah, 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 blah. Who gives
some
a fuck?
People. This is the thing. Some people do need to know stuff like that. Just as some people, I mean, I really don't want to devolve into saying that everyone's different and horses for courses. But I do think that there are types of people who do need that kind of knowledge and understanding. And there are other people, which I think is the majority, and I don't despise them at all for this. I think it's just a reality. The majority don't need to know history or science or philosophy to bring Molyneux back into this. That is an absurdly optimistic view of mankind, which inevitably leads to dreadful disappointment because the public, the rabble, will never live up to your expectations of them. What they need ultimately is practical skills, to be respected and taken seriously, and to be told, here's how to live a good life. And then they need an economy and a culture that facilitates that good life. That is really all that the common man needs. And there's nothing wrong with that. This is the animal that we have to work with. This is the human material that we have to work with. And I think that any society must be crafted or designed or evolved to take that into account. And one of the big delusions we have nowadays is that people are objective. And I think that even Stefan Molyneux, as you say, even he falls for it. I mean, it's a case there of an intellectual thinking that everyone else is an intellectual. This is the weird thing, because at the same time, he knows that they're not, because he goes on about how stupid so many people are. He goes on about how unintelligent people are. But that's the despondency that comes from having expected them to be clever in the first place. You know, if you didn't make that mistake, then you wouldn't be disappointed with them and you wouldn't resent them. And I think there is a part of Molyneux that resents the common man, actually.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. There, more than race realism, there needs to be cognitive realism. And this is, I think, a consequence of this white egalitarian mindset that everyone is the same or everyone ought to have the same opportunities. Now, I'm not saying we should close doors to people, but we should also... There's the kid on the block who's going to be the mathematician, and then there's virtually everyone else who's going to be a construction worker or a plumber or a concert pianist. I mean, they're not going to be crunching numbers. They're not going to be like, what's that Russell Crowe movie, The Beautiful Mind, doing all these insane mathematical formulas in his garage. What education ought to have been was stratified, a caste system where, all right, here's the brainiacs. Sorry, Timmy, you know, you might have 129 IQ, but you need 137 IQ. So we're going to have to be a sociologist, Timmy. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with sociology. I study sociology. I read about it. It's important stuff. I'm not denigrating, like you're saying, I'm not denigrating any particular avenue of education or vocational pursuit, but I'm denigrating this notion that anybody can. I don't know if you ever saw the show American Idol. Obviously, it's an American program.
No, I haven't actually.
It's what's his name? Simon Cowell. It's like The Voice. It's like all these types of programs.
And yeah, I do know it now. Yes, there's a British version called Pop Idol, but I don't know if it was quite the same. You might have to describe it briefly.
So they had I can't even remember their name. The bass player from Mountain. They had this Middle Eastern singer who was popular in the early 90s, and they had Simon Cowell. People would come on. They would learn a song. They would perform, and if they performed well, then they would, you know, get a contract or whatever.
Yeah, it's exactly the same as Pop Idol. Yeah, not that I watch Pop Idol, of course.
And I don't watch American Idol. I just know that this happened. So there's this guy William Hung. This is like maybe 10, 11 years ago, an Asian guy who I think was at MIT or something, like studying.
That's like a joke because people would call him Will Hung.
Well, he was Asian, so probably not. But he was like studying chemical engineering or something, and he signed up for American Idol as a laugh. And so he did a Ricky Martin song, She Bangs, which was popular when I was younger, you know, Latino heartthrob, and he was really, really bad, like as bad as you could possibly imagine. Pitch deaf, tone deaf, can't enunciate anything, moved like someone who's strung out on heroin, and he actually became like a pop culture icon. And that, to me, I'm sure he enjoyed it. I'm sure it was a great laugh for everybody involved. I'm sure lots of people made money, but there's a certain kind of evil to that where it's like, we're going to elevate people who have no business being here because it's all a big laugh. And do they know that they're in on the laugh? Probably not, but hey, it's going to be a spectacle. Lots of people are going to make money. How many young people that I went to school with were the William Hung of their college or their high school where it's like, I don't belong here. Why is everyone pretending I belong here?
Yeah, as you say, what is needed is obviously some kind of stratification so that people can get the educations that they need. I think that's absolute. But it's interesting how it violates, well, the egalitarianism that we're supposed to believe in. And we're also supposed to believe that different kinds of people including kids, school kids, should mix together, and that's how they will somehow benefit each other. But that's not always the case. But the reason we have to put up with this is that well, is egalitarianism, which is just as I've forgotten who it was who said that it's a revolt against nature. Who was that? Oh my God, was it? I think it was might have been Murray Rothbard. I'm not sure. Actually, I'll ask the live chat. Who was it who said that egalitarianism is a revolt against nature? Can anyone remember? I think it was might have been a Jewish libertarian. I'm not sure. Actually, that brings me back to a question that I was going to ask you, because as you said at the start, you you went through a libertarian phase, and you also talked about MAGA and all this. But and I asked you why MAGA wasn't enough, why Trump wasn't enough. But I think I'd also like to ask you the same question about libertarianism, which is not quite the same as, you know, MAGAism. So, but why would you, if someone were to ask you out of the blue, why is libertarianism not enough, or why is it not realistic, or whatever? What would you say as a former recovering libertarian yourself?
Well, there was a very just visceral, practical reality where I would talk to other people who identified as libertarians about the things that I thought were problems, namely immigration, demographics, things of this nature. And people would say, there's this libertarian kind of ideal, this atomizing, individualistic ideal where nothing outside of my private property borders matters. Whereas somehow there's no like miasma of influence in the air that will somehow stop just because I've got my 500 square feet or 30 acres or whatever, and the global homo won't infiltrate into my property because I've got my private, because I've got my borders. And so these are people who I've been reading a lot of Nietzsche. I've been reading a lot of Schopenhauer, and these were guys who were basically saying the whole world is will, everything is will. And I just saw libertarianism as a philosophy of non-will, of not acting. And this is what I didn't like about libertarianism, is it pulled white men out of the political sphere. And that's, I think, partly why we are where we're at.
That's a very interesting way to characterize it. Cause it's something that I've spotted myself in libertarians, that they have this sort of reticence about almost everything. It's like they just don't want to get involved. Just leave me alone with my liberty. And it's not that they don't care about the rest of society, but they seem to just hope for the best, actually. It's like, I'll just hope for the best, that society won't come and crush me one day. And also they don't want to interfere with other people's choices, their life choices and all that. But then again, okay, so what happens when your neighbor is dealing meth or he's giving his children heroin or something? Well, that's his choice, right? And it's his kid's choice to take it. So what are you going to do? Obviously, the libertarian would say, well, I would tell him not to do that. But, well, okay, how are you going to enforce that? But also, why shouldn't you care? And of course you're going to care. And then, of course, you don't want your own kids being subjected to that and all the rest of it. I mean, clearly there is a need for force in society. There is a need for power and authority in order to get things done and keep things okay. And I think that libertarianism seems to be this massive sort of rationalization for disengagement from life in general and society in general. And I know that some libertarians will say that's very simplistic, that they don't disengage, they have jobs and whatever. Yeah, fine, you take part in the economy, but you're still disengaged at a sort of spiritual level from all the people around you. And I think that seems to be a sort of prerequisite for libertarianism. At some level, you have to stop caring or just not be bothered with the fate of the people around you, and your children, and of course your descendants. And that is not something that most people can sustain. I think it takes a high IQ to sustain it, and it is delusional and unhealthy, which is why only intelligent people can manage to do it.
You had the great order, Jared, as your first guest earlier today, who I actually like quite a bit. And something that him and No White Guilt, they talk about on their show is having love for your people. Now, I said earlier, I've always been a sensitive kind of person, an empathetic person. When I was a kid, if I saw a homeless person on the street, it really bothered me. It didn't just bother me walking by him. It bothered me later that day. It bothered me later that week. I'm not a wilting flower, but I don't like to see people in a bad spot, particularly if there's something that can be done about it. I couldn't understand. This guy is 10 blocks away from my house. Everyone else around him has a home and heating and all of this stuff. Why does he have to be here? Stefan Molyneux would say, well, a low IQ and poor people make bad decisions and blah, 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 blah. And that's true. But right, I don't
so
have...
So what do we do with them? I mean, yeah, of course it's true. So then what? I mean, are we just going to hope for the best for them, just leave it to the winds of fate? Or are we going to celebrate, accept, and exert authority in order to help them? That's the choice. It comes down to that in the end. You've got to either reject authority like a fucking coward, or you've got to accept it and use it productively, like a man, I would say.
Oh, absolutely. That I totally agree. Yeah, there's something very masculine about embracing force, embracing violence, embracing the just use of aggression for the betterment of everybody. And that, just to the point about the great order and no white guilt, they talk all the time about having love for your people, about exerting force for your people. And there's something very noble about that. It's not just noble. I hate this word because it's a prog Marxist word, but it's empowering. Like, it really is. Like, I don't watch anime stuff, but I've seen like the GIFs of Dragon Ball Z characters where the lightning like pops up around their body and they become super powerful. Like, that's how I feel inside when I embrace this compassion for my people, my history, my culture. It's, I can do more than I could do before. And libertarianism had the opposite effect on me. It made me weaker, anemic, cowardly. Yeah, it's very feminine, which, by the way, since there are so many Jewish people involved with it, that's not too surprising to me.
No, there is definitely a certain link between, I mean, there is something feminine about the Jewish mindset, about the Jewish psyche, let's say. But let's not get too much into that. Everyone is scared nowadays on YouTube, and I have to admit that I am too, because God knows what you can get away with saying nowadays. I suppose that this has been a very interesting conversation already, but I'm not sure whether to just sort of wrap it up at that, because it's been so enjoyable. Because that is a question about libertarianism that it's a difficult thing to say briefly, to say concisely. But I do think, like someone, just to bring it back, because I saw a comment there, someone said that we're saying that not being a socialist is cowardly. It's cowardly to not be a, so that's what we're saying. No, we're saying it's cowardly to be disengaged and to stop yourself from caring about the well-being of other people around you. And that doesn't mean that that socialism is the only way to help them. That's a silly simplification. No, I don't think that the alternative to libertarianism is either, so although it could be one alternative, I'm not saying it's the only alternative, socialism or overbearing state control, but certainly you should have a concern for other people. I mean, for God's sake, how autistic would you have to be to not see that? I don't understand.
Yeah, every mainstream right-wing political theory in America, and maybe probably less so in Europe, because you have less of a socialist boogeyman, I think. There's a more of a coalition mentality in European politics, and a lot of the right wingers are kind of socialists. But here it's like, if you watch CRTV, you know, respect to Gavin McInnes, who's recently been banned, or you watch Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity, virtually everyone but Tucker Carlson in the mainstream, socialism is like, it basically is a synonym for bad, evil, satanic, everything that's awful in the world. And these are just silly, I think, ahistorical, non-factual ways of thinking about things. Something my friend Jefferson Lee said on his program recently: if you want to solve problems, stop thinking in terms of ists and isms, because those are just slamming doors shut in your brain to free and open conversation.
I definitely agree. I think that this thing that a lot of people have about socialism, you actually see it in Britain as well. I think a lot of YouTubers, I won't name names, but there are YouTubers that I think adopt that American contempt for socialism in order to please their American audiences. So I see it even in Brits, because it is a sort of simplistic notion that socialism just means like huge welfare, huge bureaucracy, everyone being lazy, and lots of corruption. And it always leads to communism. It's just a sort of prototype for, or dress rehearsal for communism. But I'm not even interested in pushing or justifying or defending socialism. I'm just saying there is this simplistic treatment of it that seems to be common in America, and I think it's because of the whole Cold War thing, the Red Scare. I would guess that's where it comes from. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I think that's a good point too. Another thing that was a massive disillusionment for me moving out of MAGA was exactly what you just talked about. Virtually every American myth, and I don't mean myth in a negative sense, I mean like a foundational myth, the myth of the nation, the myth of the people, were fictions that were used to justify the and I'm trying to steer my language away from certain buzzwords that would get you in trouble, but from certain moneyed influences, international moneyed influences that just played one foreign power off of another to the mutual benefit of neither. So the Cold War, oh my God, communism. Yeah, but you know, there, what are you allowed to talk about with Stalin? Because depending where you sit ideologically, he's bad because he's the scapegoat for Lenin, or he's the scapegoat for this, or he's the scapegoat for that. But what did America really do? I mean, if you read Richard B. Spence, the historian, his book, Wall Street and the Russian Revolution, you wouldn't have Bolshevism without America. You wouldn't have Bolshevism without the Anglo bankers. So like all of the foundational myths that I was arguing about on my early podcast with my friend Jefferson, it was all bullshit. And that pushed me further away from this.
Yeah. And of course, then you've got the next one, which is the, you know, World War II and the fight for freedom and the fight for equality. Because I've heard young people actually saying that World War II, we fought for equality. But let's leave that aside. There clearly is a conception among the baby boomer generation that World War II was a necessary war in order to fight for freedom and what else? Democracy and capitalism. But I think that, again, is just basically a load of bollocks. A load of nonsense.
I'm familiar with that, yeah.
Yeah, I used that word and then realized that the person might not be familiar with it. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying one thing or the other about World War II. I'm just saying that it was not, I don't believe it was fought for democracy. I don't believe it was fought for equality, for sure. I don't believe it was even fought for freedom. I think that these are things that the baby boomers have been taught from day one, and it's now a foundational part of their identity, which is why it's going to be, this is another reason, like this whole thing about the boomer Republican. It's going to be very difficult to get them out of this race-blind mindset, that, you know, the sort of Alex Joneses of the world. I think he's only in his early 40s, actually, or he might even still be in his 30s. I'm not sure. But anyway, that sort of mentality, it's going to be very difficult to get them out of it because they've had it for 60 years, and they can't conceive of caring about race. And by the way, the boomers are the same in this in Europe as well. So it's definitely something that came that reached its zenith with them. And I think actually everyone since then has believed in it slightly less or less fervently than the boomers have, because for them it's core to their identity, and it's core to their rejection of, you know, everything that came before them.
Yeah, well, speaking in, you know, where I live and what I've seen, it's especially among like middle-aged Republican men, is not that there's a race blindedness, but there's like a split consciousness. So I'll just use some of the older men that I've known in my life. They will openly say how the problems of America are, you know, to use an Eric Stryker term, I don't know if you know who that is, the J leftists, which is coded language. But then they'll turn around and say, we love Israel. So it's like there's a split consciousness there where they're not really able to think in a clear-headed way or replace any demographic. It's like, well, I love Jimi Hendrix, but man, it's those damn African Americans. It's like there's a split consciousness where they can't think in a clear-minded way about it. I know, because I've had these conversations with them, where they can intuit problems with demographic problems, but then not make that final leap forward. And it has a lot to do with the one of the reasons I call my program No Apologies is because I find a timidity and an apologetic nature to white people that is morally and existentially repugnant. And I think that's part of this split consciousness.
Do you think that, I mean, what I said there about that Gen X and millennials believe this slightly less fervently than the boomers do, that might be utterly delusional. But what I mean is, I think that it's not political for us in the way that it's political for them. They have to believe that, well, in America's case, they have to believe that Israel is our greatest ally, for example. And of course, that race doesn't matter. I wonder about Gen X and the millennials and Gen Z. What would you say about them? Do you think that obviously they've grown up with propaganda about egalitarianism and so on, but do you think they're in a better position to shake that off, or do you think they're in a worse position? I mean, psychologically, spiritually, or however you want to look at it, do you think that they are more, that there's more hope for them or less? What would you say?
I think removing the generational component of it for a second. I think there's a general trend away from the propagandized version of history. It'll be hardest for boomers. I think a lot of Gen X people kind of are maybe outside of this paradigm, but personal nihilism and whatever happened to that generation is keeping them. I can't speak too much about them. I don't know a lot about them. A lot of them did very well in the corporate world. A lot of them kind of bought into the system to some degree. There's a pervasive nihilistic kind of ethos in the 90s that I think is screwing with a lot of Gen X and their mindset. Millennials are the human punching bags for why everything is wrong with the way that the world is today, which is a convenient scapegoat. It's a way to not criticize boomers because millennials are very clearly the failures. They're the embodied failure of the boomer generation. Among millennials, I think there's a split because they were the internet generation. They had access to a lot of great information. I think there's just a lot of different pockets of millennial types. It's hard to speak about them monolithically. Gen Z, without revealing too much about my profession, I work with a lot of younger people. I don't think they're any better at all. I don't think they're any better, and I don't have any hope for them.
Oh, God, that's depressing. As people are saying in the live chat there that, you know, Gen Z have obviously grown up with this very, quite intensely, even more than the millennials did, and that they are sick of the pause and of being minorities. You don't see any of that when you deal with them?
I live in a very metropolitan urban area, and I work with that population, so... I see more of like the Ocasio-Cortez, Vice News, now this style population. So I've met frustrated young people, but they're aimless, they're shiftless, they're anesthetized by weed and smartphones and things like this. Not to be anti-weed or smartphone, but I could be entirely wrong. I could be dealing with the wrong sample size. Not everyone is a Nick Fuentes, and even Nick Fuentes has his, I think, peculiarities, right? Or the Nick Fuentes types. Some of these woke Gen Z types who are doing politics. I think it's a rough road for every generation moving forward. A positive road, ultimately, but a rough one.
Yeah, it definitely is. I think that there's a lot of work to be done in reaching people and waking them up. But the good thing is that once you do wake them up, they don't tend to go back to sleep ever, really. So anyway, let's leave it at that. I think this has been a good concise hangout, and people can go to your channel and see your own material, your own videos. So Josh from No Apologies, thank you for taking part in Millennial.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this, and have a good rest of the show.
Okay, thank you very much. And I'll be back in about 40 minutes with, DeMarcus Leibowitz. So that should be interesting. All right, I'll see you then. Bye-bye for now.